Hello, and welcome everyone to the launch of Oncology Decoded: Cancer Science Meets Clarity. We're very pleased to have you all here and join us virtually as well as in person. The reason why we started this is too often groundbreaking research remains in journals, disconnected from the real-world practice. Our goal is to change that, to translate science into actionable, patient-centered solutions that truly make a difference. We focus on critical gaps in community oncology care and ensuring that no patient is really left behind. What sets us apart is to support our commitment to real-world clinical decision-making rather than simply presenting trial data. I really want to extend our sincere gratitude to Cancer Network for this opportunity, my co-host, Ben Garmazy, for his expertise, collaboration, all of our panel members that are joining us today to launch this first three episodes for Oncology Decoded. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention my wife, Maitri, for supporting me in launching this and developing this and making this a reality. So with that, we will dive into today's discussion. All right. Well, welcome back. We are going to start off a second episode with prostate cancer. So today, we're fortunate to have three guest speakers with me and Ben. Dr. Morris, can you start?
Sure. Dave Morris, Nashville Urology Associates, a private practice group with an active clinical research arm.
Hi, I'm Tanya Dorf. I'm the Section Chief for Genitourinary Cancer Program at City of Hope in California.
Mark Fleming with Virginia Oncology Associates. I'm also the chair of the GU committee with Sarah Cannon Research Institute.
And then we all know Ben. So we're going to talk about beyond hormones, optimizing outcomes, and when do we actually treatment intensify in metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. And we're going to get quite an interesting conversation, I'm hoping. All right, so this is a session, so beyond hormones, and when do we optimize or intensify therapy in hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. So I'm just going to start off with a case. There we go. So a 50-year-old male, very similar to the questions before, hematuria 1 to 2 weeks, penile pain, PSA of 37.9, MRI showing a 4.2 centimeter mass-like lesion that replaces the transitional zone and infiltrates the peripheral zone, Gleason 4 plus 5 adenocarcinoma, and PET PSMA scan, prostate gland, right pelvic sidewall, left retroperitoneal lymph node, and germline testing is negative. And so I'm just going to ask our panel here to start off the conversation. How would you actually approach this? We'll start off with Dr. Morris. What do you think?
So we're big believers in intensification, combination therapy, and most of the large urology groups have really tried to push that idea. So we would probably intensify with radiotherapy and with combination ADT plus an ARSI in this patient, but he doesn't meet the criteria, at least high enough risk or high enough volume that we would encourage or push towards triplet with chemotherapy.
I'm curious, Dr. Dorf, Dr. Fleming, how would you approach this patient?
Well, the real question is, would Dr. Morris refer the patient to me to be seen first?
Ben will answer for you, because he's in my market.
So I think the caveats of this trial, if you look at the definitive data that what strikes me, this is a 50-year-old, so it's a little bit slightly different, but this patient does not meet the criteria for high burden disease. And so if I was taking a test, I would be saying that I would offer the patient abiraterone, radiation therapy, and hormonal therapy. But in the setting of a 50-year-old, I might be pushed to quadruple therapy, and if Dr. Morris referred this patient to me, we'd have the conversation regarding, hey, let's do chemotherapy, even though it doesn't fit the criteria, an AR-targeted drug, hormonal therapy, and then on the back end, I would consider radiation therapy off of that perspective. Understanding that it's not the Dr. Dorf kind of academic approach, I'm teasing Tanya from that perspective, but I understand that, but I would have that discussion with the patient.
Yeah, I typically would approach this with doublet therapy and have a discussion about chemotherapy, but I think the radiation is really going to do that extra debulking that we would have been asking chemo for if the symptomatic kind of big burden of disease was somewhere besides the prostate. So we always have to sort of let our patients know that there are, you know, more than one right answer, and see, you know, are they in a headspace where they want to throw everything at this and not have decisional regret if the cancer comes back. But my typical approach would be doublet with an AR pathway inhibitor and radiation.
And I'm going to jump in there because I'm going to pick on Dr. Fleming because he just picked on both of our panelists. So, you know, Dr. Morris, you know, he's part of Sarah Cannon, but silver Fermi patients, no shade intended. I'm joking. But I actually think docetaxel is incredibly aggressive here. I think it's very rare that in this setting, and the same reason that I think Dr. Dwarf mentioned, I like the idea of how do we reduce and try to reduce the potential resistant clones to hormonal therapy. And is docetaxel going to do that? Yes. Is radiation going to do that? Yes. Do we need both? We don't know. There are some data sets out there that are exploring both. So you're following what a lot of academics are studying, right? So, but I just personally don't know that we're quite there yet. So I'm not sure that personally most of my patients would even have a docetaxel discussion in this setting. And I assume Manoj, you're looking at me weird though. So I'm again, nope. You're agreeing?
No,
maybe?
I'm agreeing with you. Okay. I was just going to ask, is like, you know, when we're talking about this kind of patient that's young, we're saying we wouldn't do chemo, we would do radiotherapy. Would you offer surgery for someone that has a really good response? That's kind of what I was thinking about while you were answering the question.
So we're not part of the SWOG trial. I would mention it to the patient, and they could travel if they really wanted to. If the retroperitoneal lymph node is accessible, it would be at least discussed if they were gung-ho and fit and looked like a good surgical candidate. And then, I would refer to Ben, because we'd get somatic testing up front too. And if this patient had any aberrant RB1, TP53, P10, I'd be sending them on for a discussion about, you know, the kitchen sink approach. Because he's young and has multiple risk factors for not doing well. But surgery would be on the table.
I think that's a good point, though, those molecular subtype that Dr. Morris so intelligently brought up, right? So that aggressive variant signature, TP53, RB1, right, and P10 loss, you have two of those three, you have an aggressive variant signature. Those patients probably are going to do less well with hormonal therapy because those tumors are not as hormonally driven. So maybe in those settings, chemotherapy may be appropriate. Because you actually might need chemo because the hormone drugs aren't going to do that. Dr. Dwarf, what are your thoughts on that specific molecular subtype in this patient setting?
We obviously don't have data yet. We know they do poorly, and it would make me a little bit more interested in pushing towards chemotherapy for sure. So that's one of the arguments for doing somatic testing early, even though most of our actionable findings are only acted upon in the mCRPC setting, but the one thing that we do think about is if you find a very aggressive signature, you might react differently. At least you might follow them more closely, but you might offer them a little more aggressive treatment as well.
So let it be known that Dr. Morris, our humble community urologist, is talking about molecular aggressive variant subtypes. So kudos. But anyways, I'll throw it back to you, Dr. Bhupathi.
I'm curious, how, you know, with the left retroperitoneal lymph node, would you consider this patient as an oligometastatic patient? I mean, how wide does that definition go? Does that include up to 5 spots, 4 spots? I mean, we've seen such huge variation. How does it vary from where you all are?
I mean, certainly less than 5, and, you know, a little bit about, location, distribution. You know, I think 5 spots that are in completely different organs and sites feels different than, you know, a few retroperitoneal nodes and one pelvic bone met, right? So there's also that gut instinct and distribution, but we would try to radiate that node too if we're radiating the prostate. I am worried about the hematuria and penile pain. I don't know, should we be considering some kind of MRI imaging or a cystoscopy?
Well, I mean, it looks like just the MRI doesn't show extension into the penile tissues, but I've seen these horrible cases that are like T4 extension, and they just don't do well. We'd still debulk them with the same systemic therapy, but, I mean, this person may end up with a catheter or may present with a catheter very quickly after their presentation. So it's a great point that they're going to need potentially some local therapy. Hopefully radiation does it. They may end up with debulking like a TERP if they end up with more symptomatic progression.
I mean, it makes me think of ductal a little bit to present with the hematuria. I know we're not given that in the case, but that's another thing where sometimes I think a little bit more about pushing for chemo.
Mark, how would you define oligometastatic? What's your threshold to say I'm going to be aggressive and radiate and then give them triplet or give them a doublet afterwards?
I agree with Tanya, the less than five would be kind of my kind of cutoff. What I like about this panel, which I think this patient needs, is multidisciplinary input. And so we're affiliated with a medical school, and I always try to teach the residents that someone with Gleason 9 prostate cancer is a different disease, and so you should have a multidisciplinary approach. And so I think the fact that we're having the discussion is really the most important thing, that there's a lot of different ways that you can approach this this case.
I think we can all just agree that ADT monotherapy is the wrong answer.
Wrong answer. Yes. So it sounds like we'd probably choose some of either two or three.
It's
all good. So, you know, but part of the reason is this continuum of oligometastatic disease, right? So we know that it's how we define cure or quote unquote cure for these oligometastatic patients really changes based on the number of extensive disease that we're looking at. And that's kind of really what I was trying to highlight here. And that's why I was asking the question for the panel here is like, you know, these patients that are presenting to you with all those tiny red spots versus the one, I mean, I think how I think about them is very, very different. And it sounds like that's kind of what the panel is thinking about them as well. And again, this is the Stampede arm. I was looking at low burden standard of care plus radiotherapy versus high burden standard of care plus radiotherapy versus standard of care alone. And that's kind of what we were talking about right now. And then the doublet versus the triplet therapy. And then, you know, kind of looking at the functional ability, the nadir of time, low volume, high volume, older age or less younger age and such. And this is a very busy slide, but kind of talking about all the therapies I looked at, either the doublet therapy or even the triplet therapy and what their outcomes are. But I'm not going to really focus on this. I'm more interested in hearing what you guys would do in a real world setting, right? So if you started a patient like this on triplet therapy, or even you radiated and you gave them 2 years of ADT plus ARSI, when do you say that this is okay to stop, or what would be your next step?
Well, so if he's, now the mic's not working either. If he's truly metastatic, you know, there's no data for treatment discontinuation yet. And yet, I think many of us do it, especially in this modern era of radiating the prostate primary and radiating the oligomet. So in this case, if the patient is struggling with side effects, if they've achieved a good deep remission, which includes repeating imaging, not just by PSA, then we have a conversation, but I essentially tell patients to expect that the PSA will rise again, that this is a holiday and not you're done, you're cured, because I think setting that expectation is really important. Until we have data that says there are some people and what percentage is that it never comes back, I feel like in my own practice, someone like this, it's the majority probability is we're not cured.
Yeah, and I'd like to jump in there. So we're talking about oligometastatic and what's the duration of therapy, but we haven't really defined for those listening what is oligometastatic disease. We talked about number of lesions, and I think we all kind of agree that that's about right, 5 or less, 4 or less, 3 or less, somewhere in the ballpark. Depending on how aggressive you want to be, that's okay. But Dr. Dorf also made an excellent point about depends where the site of the disease is and you know where you feel it. So I'm going to toss it over to Dr. Fleming here. Does site of the disease matter in oligometastatic therapy when you think about definitive radiation to the prostate or prostatectomy, definitive SBRT to those oligometastatic lesions, and then applying some other additional hormonal intensification? We'll throw the docetaxel out for now just for the sake of the conversation. But are you thinking about the location of where that metastasis is when you make that decision?
Absolutely. So I think visceral disease is a different disease, so disease in the lung or liver. But lymph node disease, I am more apt to kind of radiate those sites of disease and a few bone lesions as well. So
lymph node good, bone good, visceral out, including lung, liver, and whatever else we can come up with.
You might convince me to do something in the lung if it's an isolated lesion, but something in the liver is a totally different disease.
Okay, and then Dr. Morris, obviously you treat a lot of advanced prostate in this hormone-sensitive setting. Do you think about site of metastasis when you, because I know you refer patients for oligometastatic treatment in this paradigm, we are on tumor boards together. So how do you think about this patient?
Very similar to what you just said,
Dr. Bone Fleming, and
I think lymph node is the best risk. I think we're all aware of that, and bones are worse, and visceral is the worst. So I would not, all day long, I would radiate one or two or three lymph nodes, and even one or two lung lesions, and even one or two bone spots. But one or two liver lesions, I think we're moving more into the chemotherapy biopsy of that, try to analyze that tissue because it is becoming less prostate at that stage.
Yes. And I agree. In Nashville, maybe we're cowboys and cowgirls, right? But we're thinking lung, maybe we can radiate some of those spots. We do know that lung mets, while they're visceral, those patients do better than liver mets. Liver mets is obviously completely different, and we're not thinking in that same paradigm. But Dr. Dorf, what are your thoughts on lung? Because I guess we have a consensus, unless you're telling us we're wrong, on bone and node, but maybe lung is on the fence.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, that's what the data show, that lung does not behave as aggressively as liver.
So would you treat an oligometastatic patient with lung mets with radiation to the lung spots?
I have used SBRT to an isolated lung met, yes.
I think it's, you have an MDT clinic up here, but the one thing missing is the most important person to define who we do MDT therapy in, and that's our radiation oncology colleagues. But if you ask Dr. Spratt, he's going to radiate up to 10 or 12 spots. So it's a little bit different argument in some communities, but I think most of us, it's certainly a limited number is a better outcome. Like you've said, it's what's your intent. Are we kicking the can down the road, or are we crossing our fingers we're going to cure you?
And I think it warrants mention that we also have to treat the whole patient. We're talking a lot about doublet and triplet and radiation and this and that, but we have to prepare our patients for the psychological burden of castration therapy. We have to make sure we pay attention to bone health and cardiovascular health, because it's terrible if we end up actually curing this guy, which would be wonderful, but we end up leaving him with excess cardiovascular risk that we could have mitigated had we involved a cardiologist or paid some attention. So the prescription doesn't stop at all the drugs. There's more to be done beyond that.
So adding on to that, but given the toxicity that we're seeing, right? So it kind of goes to the de-escalation, right? So when do you say that you can stop your ADT but continue on a DARA or an ENZA or APA monotherapy and say we'll just kind of see how it goes?
Or when can you stop altogether, I guess?
Yeah, that'd be the other,
right? So let's toss that to someone.
I never stop the ADT and keep them on a mono. I would try de-escalating the ARPI first, right? You can dose reduce, and actually sometimes it makes a big enough difference that someone's able to complete their course of therapy or stay with the therapy if you use dose reduction.
But when do you feel comfortable doing that? So PSA, you've radiated, you've started it, PSA is undetectable. How many months do you want it to be undetectable before you start to feel comfortable in a healthy person who's not having side effects to de-escalate that therapy?
Oh, we're not de-escalating unless they're having side effects.
But, okay, right? I got it. So you're going continual. You've radiated all the sites of disease.
So we already talked about considering after
two years. Okay.
You know, treatment holiday. 2 years is my amount. I know two some years. People use less than that.
But I think Tanya brought up a point. I think patients are going to really drive that decision, because that's a common question. Well, Dr. Fleming, can I stop? I don't want to take hormonal therapy anymore. And so patients come to me and ask to stop. And I kind of say the risks and benefits of doing so, but you know, you can't totally endorse their decision based upon the data to stop hormonal therapy, but we all have patients who stop.
I'll go out on the island that you were out on earlier, and there was actually a poster on it at this year's event with the ADT Abby, and I might not do it in retroperitoneal nodes that are truly oligometastatic, but if you're nodal disease that is treated, so pelvic disease, and we're looking at 2 years of therapy, I'll do ADT and Abby combined for a year, and then actually stop the ADT and continue Abby monotherapy and then stop that when we get closer to 2 years, and then their T recovery is faster. So if we really think we've cured them, and it's certainly not the more lesions we're radiating, but if I really think I've cured them and they are the sort of person who wants to get back to eugenatal state, I'll use that approach. But I'm shocked at the number of people who I bring up de-escalation because I think we've consolidated them, and they say, no, I'm happy to stay on treatment. It's actually surprising.
Yeah, there are those who value that PSA being undetectable more than anything else. And this is why we really need to listen to the patients, right? And you mentioned that. But SWOG 9346, and I'm a SWOG, you know, leader and champion and cheerleader, but SWOG 9346 was a very imperfect trial, and that is what we're saying continuous is based on, and that's also what was used in all of these trials that you have on your very nice summary slide. But intermittent versus continuous, intermittent was not inferior, it was just not non-inferior, right? So that difference was not enormous. And for a man who looks at me and says, I have no life, like I cannot live like this, I think that has to play a role in going beyond the dogmatic kind of data say to do this, but there's a human being and a family and a life that we're dealing with.
Interesting. You know, earlier, Dr. Dorf, you had said you want not only the PSA, but also imaging, right? So are you getting conventional imaging and PET PSMA imaging? Are you using PET PSMA for surveillance? What are you doing?
So I am in the academic hot seat. you know, it's challenging. The rest of the world laughs at us for using still conventional imaging, right? We know it's inferior to PSMA PET imaging for sensitivity and specificity. That being said, I think comparing apples to apples is my number one goal. So if the imaging before treatment was PSMA PET, and they come to me and they've started their doublet, they're 6 months into their doublet, and I want to know how they're doing, a CT and a bone scan is going to be very hard to interpret in that context, and I ideally would get a PSMA PET. Now I can't always get it covered. My NP spends a lot of time, you know, fighting for these things. So if I can't, then yeah, we'll switch over to CT bone scan. But I think eventually the field will move to monitoring with PSMA PET. And isn't the sort of basic principle to use the same type of imaging throughout? Like in clinical trials, if they got an MRI at baseline, they get MRI imaging throughout. If they got CT, they get CT, right? Because it's just so hard when you switch.
I would say in the community, we've totally moved to PSMA PET. But with Gleason 9 disease, I will periodically get a CT bone scan from the standpoint we have to worry about. If it's a new site, if I get concerned that they've de-differentiated to a neuroendocrine, which I see, with Gleason 9-10 disease, I will be more apt to get a CT bone scan at some point in time. And I tend to image anywhere in the 1 to 2 year time frame, regardless of what their PSA is doing.
And can I ask a question then? So you have a patient with PSA, undetectable. We said we're going to go about 2 years on this patient unless they have reasons to come off. PSA is still undetectable. Are you getting follow-up imaging? And if so, how often do you think you need to get it?
I usually do it within a 1 year to 2 years time frame. And I will try to get a PSMA PET. It's hard to get a PSMA PET covered if the PSA is down. And so then you have to get a CT bone scan as a baseline.
So 1 to 2 years, what do you think?
But your point is so good about dedifferentiation and lack of PSMA expression, and certainly our radiologists tell us that PSMA PETs are not great in the liver. They can be very hard to read, and you can miss liver disease. So when we're worried about it, it should either be a PSMA PET with a diagnostic contrast-enhanced CT scan that will allow us to look in the liver. And your points well taken about maybe a bone scan to see if there are non-avid lesions.
Dr. Morris, how often do you guys image these? These are not patients that we always see in the community. What do you guys do?
It's probably imperfect. I think we shoot for we'd like to have something every year. What ends up happening is I'm reviewing my notes, trying to figure out when was the last time we had imaging, and then I'm like, oh, we're kind of due now, so let's get new imaging. Certainly, if the PSA changes, we get new imaging. Sure. If the PSA is not changing, that's where you're kind of stuck in this. There was a poster on progression by radiographic progression when no PSA change was 10% of the time in these registry trials. So we need to remind ourselves to keep doing it, even if the PSA is not changing.
I'm curious, how often do you worry about a false positive on your PET PSMA scans? I mean, we do them all the time. And how are you worried that you're getting something that's not real and that we're over-treating based on that?
I haven't had that. I have not really seen that. So I guess I've been over-treating.
I'm curious because especially the ones that come up with a lymph node SUV of like three, right? And then you, or you have a,
I think it's the rib lesions.
The ribs.
Well, that's the other part, right? Do you count them as a true spot? Like, what do you do?
Well, that's what I worry about in the application of metastasis-directed therapy and oligomet paradigms is, are people really looking at the scan? So we take anything that we're at all questioning to tumor board and have multidisciplinary eyes on it. And we really try to only treat something that we think is real. Also, it should be said, we're not supposed to categorize high volume, low volume based on PSMA PET. So if you're basing curative or non-curative or high volume versus low volume type treatment because of some lymph nodes seen on the PSMA PET that wouldn't have been picked up, I think we might be doing a disservice.
Yeah, you don't want to over or under treat those patients, either which way of that paradigm. Though it's really hard when you see things on the scan to not try to follow what you see on the scan, but you're right, the data doesn't support PSMA PET lesions as conventional lesions.
So in the interest of time, I think we covered all the questions. I'd like to thank our panel for a great discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us.